Welcome to the Global Marketing Show, the podcast for all things international business. I'm your host, Wendy Pease, president of Rapport International and a translation expert. Come along with me today as we talk to an expert in the global marketing world about facing their biggest fears, hearing about mistakes they made or saw, discussing best practices, and sharing fun travel language and culture stories.
Hello, friends and listeners to the Global Marketing Show. Thank you for tuning in again. Right now, as I'm recording this, it's summer, which makes me think of that old saying, the dog days of summer. They are certainly upon us right now. Do you know where that saying came from? It's fascinating to me. It originated from the Roman and Greek mythology and astronomy that talked about the time of year, which is late July, when the star Sirius is in the constellation Canis Major, and that it rises in the sky this time of year. So now we use the phrase, the dog days of summer, but really in the Northern Hemisphere, it really is referring back to when the stars were here. It has nothing to do with the dogs laying around all hot and lazy. So that's fun. Tidbits are brought to you by Rapport International, connecting people anywhere in the world across more than 200 languages. And a hot thing right now is global content. How do you manage it? Do you use AI? Do you use humans? Are you consistent across your different areas? Well, this is Rapport International's specialty. If you ever want to have a free consult about what your company's doing, certainly reach out. The website is rapporttranslations.com. It's in the show notes, of course, and it's spelled R-A-P-P-O-R-T, translations, just like the French word, building rapport. So today's guest, now we get to the fun part, is Artu Ajar. And he is actually fascinating. He's originally from Turkey, and he has lived near me close to Boston for years. He's very well educated. He has a bachelor's degree and two master's degrees. One's in mechanical engineering, and he did that for years before he got his MBA. And then after he got his MBA, he became a software engineer, and he's worked with some really high-profile companies like MathWorks and Amazon Robotics, Symbotic, Humanix, Right Hand Robotics. And currently, he's chief operating officer at Mercury, which is a fascinating company. They ship anywhere in the world on a moment's notice for stuff that has to be kept at a certain temperature. He's also won a big award. Business Insider named Artu to their annual list of the 10 leaders transforming manufacturing in North America. So Artu, welcome to the Global Marketing Show.
Thank you so much, Wendy. Thank you for the introduction.
Oh, it's great to have you here. So I am so curious. You mentioned once that when you moved here from Turkey when you were 20 years old, it was quite a shock to you. So people always love hearing about the culture shock people get coming into the United States. Can you tell me more about that?
Right. Yeah, I was 26 right after, as you mentioned, my first master's degree. I came to Boston. And I fell in love with Boston, to be honest, but it was a different environment than what I was used to in Turkey. Culturally, the lifestyle, it was very different. And so as a student, it took me a while to get used to it. But in the meantime, Boston is a very welcoming city for foreigners coming from around the world. So it didn't take too long, but of course, it takes some time to adjust.
So I'm so curious, what were the things that you found weird and different?
I mean, to the very basic things that you don't really know when you go to a supermarket and want to buy some detergent and you have no idea like where to start from, can be the simplest thing, all the way to transportation, finding place to rent, and you have no idea what part of the city to live in, and I basically had no connections. I didn't know anyone when I landed in Boston in August 2006. So starting from there and then building your environment, getting to know the city, where to go, what to do, and finding jobs, building your network. all of this is really starting from scratch, almost like you are like a newborn. Yeah. And you don't know what to do. You learn everything from scratch. But again, it's a great learning experience for everyone. So I have no regret doing that. And I think it makes you stronger. And you feel like you can survive anywhere in the world.
Yeah, it's interesting because when I graduated from Penn State, I moved to San Francisco. So I went, you know, I had been living in Pennsylvania and moving out to San Francisco, there was a little bit of culture shock because, you know, just the climate and the activity and how people relate. And I think one of the funniest things to me was I lived out there for 30 days before I met somebody that had actually grown up in California. There were so many people that were transplants in, but I certainly didn't have the grocery store issue and the detergent because they were pretty similar.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the simplest thing, but even if like you don't know where to go, what to do, where to buy things, it can be challenging at times. Yeah. But as you said, I mean, Boston is also a very multicultural city. So I had many people around me, especially in grad school from around the world. So it makes it easier to connect with people.
Yeah. So you certainly you obviously have an international background because you grew up in Turkey and you've lived in the United States. Now, with all those amazing companies that you've worked with, have you helped a lot of them go global?
I am helping right now my own company, I'm Mercury, to go global. The one before Mercury, I worked at Right Hand Robotics. It was already going global. They had clients. So I was part of that initiative. I can't say I initiated it, but I was part of it. So I felt the challenges of going global, selling global, dealing with different cultures, different regulations. Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about Right Hand Robotics and then we'll get more into Mercury? Can you, so they start an initiative and you're pulled in to support it. Talk to me about what their goals were and what you were involved in.
Right. Right Hand is a startup company, still a startup Series C. At the time, it was Series B, the beginning of Series B. As any startup, you would like to grow and sell. And as a startup, when you find a client, it's hard to say no. And that's the hardest part. Some startups are good at it, some are not. So when you don't say no, and then you have to comply with their requirements. And as a startup, you don't really have a fully developed product, or your product does not comply with the local regulations. And if you want to operate in Europe, in Japan, the regulations are different. Japan is not as much, but Europe is. Culturally, Japan is very different. So when you sell to those locations, the expectations, the client requirements are different than the ones we have in the US. So you need to first understand.
And down to exactly what you were doing with Right Hand Robotics.
Yes.
So your first client was in Japan, I'm assuming?
Not the first, but one of the clients, one of the first clients from Japan who bought multiple robots. This is public information. That's why I can share it.
Yes.
And they published this information. And so they were so eager to use the automated picking solution that we were developing at the time, which is great. And it's still doing great in the market. However, what Japanese markets, Japanese clients, companies would expect from a piece picking robot is different than what you would expect in the US or in Europe. A small example is a small wrinkle on the package is a no-go if you put it on the shelf. So, and that's not acceptable for the buyer. So, and in the US, when you see the wrinkle, you don't really care as much. It's not a big deal. So when the automated machine, the gripper, holds the item, if it makes a small wrinkle on it, it's not sellable anymore. So you need to be very gentle. And for a robot to be that gentle, it's more work, more engineering work. And it takes your resources, your time. Maybe it's not the best investment. You may put your resources somewhere else. And you don't know all of these things up front. That's why the problem is you don't know what you don't know until you start. That's why going to another country is always a challenge. And it may seem very simple in the beginning. It's just another location. We'll put our solution. It's a robot, software. But there are things that you may not know upfront.
So, yeah, to me, after hearing that story, it doesn't seem simple. It seems daunting because I could walk into this. So what did you do at Right Hand Robotics when you realized that there was this cultural difference?
The cultural expectations, requirement differences, you need to adjust. It's a client, you signed an agreement, then you put your resources to solve the problem. The good thing is sometimes those problems can apply to other markets or can improve your product performance. So when you go global, you almost push the boundaries of your solution, of your product, which is great. In the meantime, it may deplete your resources. So it's a matter of where you want to invest your dollar, your investment. So in that case, it made sense financially to go after that client, but it can really kill a company quickly if it's not the right decision. So if you cannot comply with their requirements for a long time. Similarly with Europe. Japan is one example, Europe is another one. In Europe, especially in the automation space, in others as well, you need to comply with CE requirements. So if you don't comply for a while, you can first start as a pilot, you can claim it's not really in production, but after a year, they are not going to accept it. So to be able to comply with CE requirements, you may need to redesign your product or make some modifications to your product. And again, those are engineering investments. It's a well-known requirement upfront. The thing that you may not know, how much effort is required. What's the delta between what you have as a product today versus what you need to do to make it CE compliant? Otherwise, everyone knows when you operate in Europe, you need to be CE compliant, CE certified. But again, how much effort? How long it's going to take? Those are all like open questions that if you haven't done it before as an organization, you may have a few people who have done this in the company. But as an organization, if you haven't done it from scratch, learning what to do, bringing the right people on board, making all the changes, going through the qualification, all of these take time. And it's about investment, like you put your dollars on.
Right. So with all that work that it seems to adapt it for different markets, why should a company go international?
Right. I mean, it's first of all, market, a new opportunity. You can sell more if your product is ready. You push the boundaries of your product. You make your product better, even if some of the changes that you make for another market might apply for your local market and or might make your product perform better in your local market or in other markets. So it's a great learning experience. I think the thing that companies should be careful about, what's the delta? Did they do their due diligence upfront? And are there less unknown unknowns? How comfortable they feel? How experienced is your team to go global? If no one in the company has done that before, then it's a bigger difficulty. So that's why they should look at it from multiple angles. But if you are successful, then of course you are going to sell more revenue, more profits. It's a bigger operation and bigger opportunities.
Out for Right Hand Robotics, when they went international, like what percent of their business ended up being from other markets outside of their home market of the US?
Yeah, again, public information. They also had client in Europe. So, but as a percentage, it might be a confidential information, so let me not share the percentage. They had clients in the US as well. So it wasn't just international. So it was a good split. But the challenge is not really the split, what percentage global, what percentage. What's the difference between your product requirements locally in the US versus globally? If the difference is not as big, then it might not be a big challenge. You can deploy many robots internationally and locally. It's really the delta between the two.
Delta, the change. Yeah, okay. So the delta or the change between the product that you have to sell internationally, that's what you have to pay attention to. Yeah. I was going back to, like, is there a way to measure ROI for going through that effort? I mean, obviously, there's a lot of good things that come from it. It's going to make you stronger in your market. But right. did they find, did you find that the payoff was worth it to go through those headaches?
Right. For automation, the reason you automate, to be honest, you want to lower the cost, increase the efficiency of your warehouse automation, and fulfill your client requirements. And automation solves your problem on the labor front. If you have labor shortage, then it's a bigger need, especially in Asia and in Japan, labor shortage is a bigger issue. So yes, it makes sense to go after those markets. In Europe, it's very expensive, so you can save a lot. That's why from an analysis point of view, when you do the analysis on paper, it justifies the ROI. Yes, you can sell, you can convince the clients, it's a bigger market, you can justify your product capabilities in that market well enough, as long as you comply with their requirements. Otherwise, going after those markets, they are smart decisions, right decisions. It's just a matter of how ready you are as a company, as an organization, to operate in those environments that you don't know.
Okay, so now you're COO at Mercury, and I know you can't violate any confidential information, but I'd love to step into your shoes now at this point of time and understand that journey that you're taking to expand internationally. Like I know you've shipped internationally for years, but how are you planning on picking up international business?
Right. As you said, we already ship to and from other countries, and we have partners globally. In a sense, we are a global company. We have a development office in Turkey, so which we build our software product. In that regard, we are a global organization. We don't necessarily have offices that for our operations function in other countries yet. And again, same question, can we justify that investment? Do we know all the requirements, all the regulations well enough? Did we do our due diligence? That's where we are right now. So we are doing our due diligence. Which countries would make sense for us to operate, and what regulations do we need to comply with that we don't have today? What's the delta and what's the market size? Again, the strategy is low cost, low risk geographies. Let's start with those and let's not put too much investment and test it. You need to test the water first, like before you get in. So you are going to start small and then see the traction. If it justifies, if it makes sense, if you operate well, then you expand. If not, there will be failures. So it can't always be a success story, but your successes should be more than your failures, of course. So choosing what country, when to go. And the general question at the C level is, what other things can we put this money on other than going global? Should we put it on product development? That's the main question. Otherwise, the question is not really, should we go global or should we not go global? You can always say, yeah, let's go global. It's great. We're going to sell more. What other things can we do with that investment instead? It comes down to, as you said, ROI. Which one has the highest ROI for us? We, as a like company growing organically, we're a profitable company. We don't take outside investment. We have that luxury to make long-term investments. So we don't need to increase our revenue over a couple of months to prove something to the board and the investors. So that's a big luxury compared to startups. But in the meantime, really, it's a matter of where you should put your money.
Right. So it's interesting because it's really, you know, going global is that new market, new client, product development is more customer experience, customer upselling, you know, can we increase the revenues more by doing that?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
With the investment. Yeah.
Again, if your company is not ready to operate globally, then you are going to fail because maybe you need a different software. You need a software or you need a third party product. You may need an accounting system for that country. You may need people operations if you are going to have people on the ground. in Europe, employment rights are very different than the employment rights we have in the US. And you can't make the same decisions as you do in the US, in Europe. For all those reasons, some companies, which is a very smart decision, they go to other countries through a PEO organization, professional right. employment organizations. So that's a good start. Again, low cost, low risk. There are organizations who can really help you on the hiring front, on the legal front. They tell you what you can do, what you shouldn't do. So, and up until you get to maybe 10, 15 people, it might be the best path forward.
Hey, as I'm listening to you, you started out with that you've got to justify the investment and you have to do your due diligence. And so there's a lot of things that you talked about: market size, regulatory, accounting, software, people on the ground, legal, you know, and then test it. So there, you know, if I'm a new exporter and I'm listening to all that, it's a lot. It's confusing. And I do know that Softland Partners has an export readiness checklist. We'll put that in the show notes. But how are you organizing at Mercury to look at the different markets to know what would be your low cost, low risk market? Do you build out a spreadsheet? Do you write a white paper, or, you know, like what, and who's involved in that?
So we create workforce. So global workforce, it's a combination of multiple functions in the company: product development, sales, marketing, finance, operations. They all get involved. So the path that we took is first do your due diligence in each function, and our VP of operations, VP of marketing, VP of product, VP of sales, they all go and check what they need to do for us to be able to VP of compliance, quality. We all go and they all go and check what they need to do, what we need to do as a company to be able to operate in that function. And they all come back with some findings. They say, for sales, I need to comply with this. For product, I need to comply with that. For operations, I need this. And then when you bring all of this together, and then you talk to your legal counsel and they give you some feedback, then it's a matter of really networking as well. So people who have done this before are the best resources for you to get insight. You go and talk to these people and get some recommendations. They then tell you, you can talk to these organizations, these PEOs. You reach out to those PEOs. You learn from them what services they can provide to you, how much it's going to cost you, how long it's going to take, what are the challenges, what can go wrong. That's the key question. What can go wrong if we try to do this? Once you figure out all of this, then you calculate the risk. What's the risk? What's the investment? What other things can we do instead? And if the decision is still, yes, we should do it, then it's a matter of executing. We now have that workforce. They are about to complete their study by the end of July. And then we are going to evaluate what to do next. So, and
how many countries are you starting with?
Just one at a time. Start again, testing the waters. We are going to try one and then see how it works and then go off. Basically, being in one country is one thing, but you need to grow in that country. It's not really a matter of being in 10 countries in like small quantities.
We want to I meant by that is when you go off to do the due diligence, you're doing due diligence on one country, or did you do it across 10 to pick one?
There are normally like some feelings from the beginning with like some data, but doesn't necessarily be a fully flushed data. You know, this country is big in healthcare life sciences versus this other country. This one country, language is not a barrier compared to this other country. Oh, the regulations, the tax laws. And then once you have that knowledge prior to the study, you can then bring it down to a number of like 2-3 countries to start with and then compare. I wouldn't really boil the ocean. I wouldn't start with like, let's look at these 20 countries and then figure out what to do. It might be too much work, a bit unnecessary to do the analysis for all countries. That's why start with like 2-3 locations and then move from there.
Okay. So you brought in language and language barriers. Mm-hmm. Of course, I'm always interested in language and culture. So can you talk to me more about how you handle that with your international operations and what you think about in the country you're going forward?
Right. I mean, English is an international language. However, when you operate in certain environments, you can't expect everyone to be able to communicate in a language that is not their local language. So that's why we need to consider language barriers, not just the clients, but the partners that we work with. So in this regard, yes, we prioritize countries speaking English first. So that's a good starting point. That would then minimize your investment on the support side, because you can support those countries from your US office. Maybe it's going to be a different time zone, but you don't need to open a new office in that country, especially, let's say, you are in France. And it may be a challenge if you only operate in English. So you need to have a support group who can speak French, and especially sales. They might appreciate more if there's a local person who can speak their language. And you should be able to communicate with your clients as well. So that's why language is a barrier, and you should first respect the local language and really do put more effort to be able to support their language in your software, in your support function. That's why starting point, if the country that you pick, English is a more common language, that's a better starting point. For more like services organizations, for more product organizations, we are more like a tech-enabled services organization. We have a product, but we provide services. If it's a pure product, just you sell software and nothing else, then your product should be able to support the local language. A great example is from MathWorks. So, and companies, especially startups, when they start building software, they should think about these type of challenges down the road. If you haven't thought about it upfront, then making those changes can be very expensive. MathWorks, when they started in 1984, if I'm not mistaken, or 83 or 84, they probably didn't think about globalization at the time. Mm-hmm. US was a big enough market. Globalization in 1984 wasn't a big thing at the time yet. So everything was in English. The software was built without considering another language. And when they started going global, after a while, in Japan, they want Japanese. In France, they want French. Germany, they want German. Maybe less so, but they still want their local language. Making those changes in the software can be very simple. If you use the right libraries, if you have the right architecture, just a matter of translation. If you haven't done that, it needs almost re-architecting your software. So that's why when I go to startups, when they start building software from ground up, even if globalization, going global, is not on the table, as a product manager, I always bring it up. I was a product manager, so like, did you think about globalization? Did you think about supporting other languages?
I am so glad that you talked about that, because that is something that I try to tell startups all the time when they're in the software industry or they're building platforms. And they look at me and kind of say, yeah, the US market is big enough, but there is story and story, you know, talking about companies that haven't thought of that. Yeah, something else that I want to revisit is in talking to some market entry strategists, they actually said that a lot of companies will start in English-speaking countries, particularly when England was still part of the EU, because they have this fear of other languages and cultures. And in the industry, we now have, I just started to use it, it's an ROI calculator. So you can see the small investment that it takes for translation and what the potential revenue is that you can gain. So even though, you know, so if you're listening to this, you got to pick the right market with all the strategy things, certainly take language in as a consideration, but also think about having less competition. And if it's a bigger market, how to figure out your communication strategy so you can support that as a company.
Correct. No, it's a good point. As long as the ROI justifies, you shouldn't be scared, afraid of going after other markets where English is not the main language. You are right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, this has been fascinating and we're running out of time, but you know, I have to ask, because I always do at the end of the podcast, what is your favorite foreign word?
Yeah, so Japanese culture is always interesting. They have many different principles, and especially the Toyota production system is something that's fascinating. And we always follow, and they have different terms in Japanese. And the one that I like the most is Genchu Genbutsu. In English, it means, if you translate it word by word, it's almost like the real location and the real thing. And what it really means is go and see yourself. When there's a problem you have information about, somebody tells you there's something wrong in the organization, you're a VP, you're in the C-suite, don't just ask people, go and observe. A great example is there was a problem in one of the manufacturing lines in the US at Toyota, and one of their executives from Japan, he flew to US just to observe that problem and talk to the people who are working on it. Not just ask your manager, VP, and then director, and then manager, and then team lead, and then the individual. So go and observe it. So that's a great principle, which we also apply here at Mercury.
That is a great one. How do you say it again in Japanese?
It's Genchi Genbutsu. I'm not sure if I'm butchering it, but it's Genchi, Genchi, and Genbutsu.
I love that. That's a new one on me. So I really like that.
Great. Yeah, yeah.
Good. Well, I think those are final recommendations. Genchi Genjutsu.
Is that? Genbutsu, yeah.
Genbutsu.
Yeah.
So go and see. Make sure you get out to other customers. So thank you so much, Artu, for being here. Where can people reach you if they want to learn more about Mercury or get in touch with you?
They can go to www.shipmercury.com to learn more about our company. Our LinkedIn page, on LinkedIn, we are very active. They can follow Mercury Business Services, the full name, with our logo you see in my background. So yeah, those are the best resources. If anyone would like to reach out to me, they can reach out through LinkedIn. So yeah.
Okay, and if anybody wants to learn more about his background and his award, we'll put the show note in the show notes. We'll also put the link to the list of people transforming manufacturing businesses. That's quite an honor.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in and listening. There's always some great golden nuggets that we learn. So I really enjoy this. If you found this interesting or helpful, or you know of somebody who's thinking about going international and doesn't know where to start, certainly forward this episode along to them, because it's some good basic advice. We'll also put the Softland Partners Export Readiness link in the show notes. So forward it along, give us a 5-star, and certainly come back and tune in to talk to us next time. Thanks so much for tuning in.
That's a wrap for this session. A big thanks to you for listening to the Global Marketing Show. Hope you had just as much fun as I did. New sessions launch weekly on all places you find podcasts, Apple, Spotify, Google Play, and of course on our website. If you know someone interested in this topic, please tell them about us. Au revoir for now.